Welcome to the Blackhawks Talk podcast. I am Charlie Romeliotis, joined by James Naveau. James, they brought us back, the two of us, again, together again. We're going to hit on some takeaways from the Mike Donahue interview that Pat and I did on Tuesday. Kyle Davidson made some front office promotions. We'll touch on that. We'll also talk about the controversial Game 4 overtime goal in Tampa Bay. Was it too many men on the ice penalty? We'll break that down. And then we'll finish up with some NHL awards results discussion. I can finally reveal my ballot. I don't have to be so secretive when we talk about it anymore.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
How you doing?
Pat Boyle steadfastly refusing to appear on air with us. We'll see how long his strike lasts.
You know what? He's currently playing some golf. He's doing something at the Glen Club. I think there's like a tournament there or something, and he's participating in it. So I'm looking forward to hearing from Pat to see how he did. And I've played with Pat a few times, and I hope he's doing well on the golf course today. But it's me and you again, James. We got some stuff to talk about. Let's start out with the Mike Donahue interview from Tuesday. So first of all, my biggest takeaway is that he revealed on the podcast that he is the permanent amateur scout. He is the new chief scout for the Blackhawks. He is not the interim. Because when Kyle Davidson was named the general manager on March 1st, he got Mike Donahue got the interim tag, but it was, I think Mike said the third week of March is when he had that interim tag lifted. So he is the permanent guy. The Blackhawks are not doing a search. He's going to be running the draft July 7th and 8th. James, I'll throw it over to you. Anything stand out to you in that interview on what Mike said and maybe his approach going into the draft?
I did kind of like the fact that you guys broke that news. That was really well done. That was intrepid reporting by both of you. I read the transcript after you guys were done, and that stood out to me just being hilarious. Like, no, I'm not the interim guy. I'm the full-time guy. And you guys both just be like, well, congratulations.
Yeah. It was also funny too, because it wasn't like, oh yeah, he pulled it a few weeks ago. It was like, oh, he pulled it in the middle of March. So I was like, oh, it's for 3 months ago. I'm glad.
Where's your press release for that, man? Like, yeah. That's what I would have asked him. I'd have been like, what is Kyle like ashamed of this? Why didn't you get like your own press release and red carpet and stuff, man? What's going on here? Aside from you guys breaking the news about that, of course, I thought that the two things that I really took away from it, one of them is something we've been talking about fairly extensively, is the Alex DeBrincat rumors have kind of ginned up, and there's a lot of talk that he could potentially be moved this offseason. And I isolated a quote from him about this where he said, I think the directive, you want to build down the middle and on defense and in goal. Your centers and your top three defensemen and your goalie are probably your most important positions. I have been on record as saying that I would be comfortable if the Blackhawks wanted to give Alex DeBrincat a long-term extension. There are not a lot of guys in the NHL that you basically can plug into your lineup and assume they're going to score between 40 and 50 goals. And it feels like Alex DeBrincat is becoming one of those guys. And I think that you can kind of make an exception to the build around the middle mentality if you have a guy that's like that, right? And I think that Alex DeBrincat fits that bill. On the other hand, the way he says that, the way you say you want to build down the middle, it's like, well, that's not going to happen if you're signing Alex DeBrincat to a $9 or $10 million contract, giving Patrick Kane, you know, Joe Pavelski money, that $6 or $7 or $8 million a season. That's not in sync with that kind of mentality. And I'm not sure if he just means organizationally that that's how they're going to do it, or if that's the way they're going to build their actual NHL roster. But that statement to me really stood out, especially with all the rumors that have been floating around about Alex DeBrincat, and really called into question the idea of whether or not the Blackhawks would seriously entertain giving him a contract extension at this point.
Yeah, for sure. And even in that quote too, I think something that jumped out at me is drafting best available player over maybe an organizational need, right? We've seen in the past, like, I feel like the last two drafts specifically, the Blackhawks going with big, heavy defensemen, right? Like it was like a specific focus. And in years prior, it was going to draft the undersized defenseman, right? That the Adam Boqvist, Henry Jokihar, you guys that can move the puck. And so it definitely felt like a concerted effort over the last several drafts to target specific needs in the organization. And I like the philosophy that he has about, you know, cautioning. You don't want, here's his direct quote. You don't want to leave that type of player. And he's talking about an organizational defenseman. If there's an elite defenseman available for the Blackhawks, he goes, you don't want to leave that type of player there just because the seventh center on your list is available and you're hell bent on centers. So you have to be open to what might fall to you and be ready for it. So I really like that approach. I've always said in the past, you got to go for the best available player over specific needs, right? And I always point to the 2015-16 draft. I can't remember when the Boston Bruins had three consecutive first round picks. It was like 14, 15, and 16. And it was basically like no name, no name. And then Jake DeBrusk is like the highest profile name in that list. And right after that three consecutive Bruins pick went Matt Barzal to the New York Islanders. And yep. I wonder if Boston didn't take Matt Barzal because they had Patrice Bergeron and David Krejci at the time, right? Like they had their one and two centers for the next 5 years basically solidified. So you don't want to caution away from just saying like, well, we don't need a center. We'll go for, you know, this. Like if that center is the best available player, even though you have a surplus of centers, you know, in Chicago's case, they could probably use some more centers in the organization. I think they should go for it, but yeah, I definitely, it's funny that we picked out, we had the same takeaway from the same quote, but you had a different takeaway. And I also had a different takeaway. And then the one thing that also jumped out at me was like, we opened the podcast with it and he was like, is speed the mantra going forward? And he said, absolutely. We want to play as fast as we can, as quick as we can. Like all the things that, like you're watching the Colorado Avalanche right now in the Stanley Cup final. It feels like the Blackhawks are trying to get to that level. Now, it's easy to play that way when you have Nathan MacKinnon and Cale Makar and guys that can really like the fastest players in the National Hockey League. But I think that's the kind of game the Blackhawks want to play. Well, they can beat you with their speed, but you know, they can also maybe shut you down. So I think, you know, those are two of my biggest takeaways, James, when we talk about, you know, the first part and then the second part of just playing with speed and finding those up tempo type players, whether it's through the draft, free agency, that feels like that's the way they want to play moving forward.
I did want to also point out, you had mentioned the best available player kind of mentality, and it's really easy for teams to say that and then to go into the draft and look to address specific needs. And he even mentioned in the interview that the Blackhawks have tended to kind of go defense heavy in the last few drafts just to kind of build up the blue line stockpile in the farm system. And I think that the temptation is going to be there this year to potentially course correct for that and go mostly forwards, maybe throw in a goaltender. But I think that it's really critical to keep that best player available mentality in mind, considering how many picks the Blackhawks have in the second and third rounds. I think that they really need to focus on guys that they feel like have dropped below the valuation that they have for them, and just to go ahead and get them no matter what position they end up playing. He listed off so many guys that have gotten taken in second and third rounds and made fairly quick impacts at the NHL level in recent years. And I think that mentality is one the Blackhawks really, they've done a good job of embracing in the past, and they really need to continue to do so and not to worry about, you know, what position that player happens to play. If you find a guy that you have a first round valuation on, he drops into the second round, I think they absolutely need to go after him. And I'm confident after listening to that interview that that's what the Blackhawks are going to do.
Yeah, definitely. And I know the Blackhawks don't have a first round pick currently, but he is preparing like
he dropped a lot of hints that they may try to package picks and move up. Like that was kind of prevalent the entire interview, wasn't it?
I felt like because they have a lot of second and third rounders, there's a possibility of packaging, you know, maybe they see a guy in the early second round that they can package a second rounder and maybe, you know, whatever, a later round pick to move up a few spots. I feel like that's what he might have been implying. I feel like if they are going to, like, he made it known, I'm going to pull this up again really quick. Like, we asked him about, they obviously don't have a first round pick right now, but he's preparing as if he does have one, right? So he goes, I just spent time at the World Championships watching three players that are going to be gone in the top 10. And he goes, I wouldn't like my first draft for Kyle to trade into the top 10 and says, who do you like? And he hasn't watched any of them, right? So it's not just like the later round first rounders that he might be looking at. Like, they are looking from 1 to 224 is what he said. And I think, you know, not having a first round pick, let's just say hypothetically it stays that way, I think he's taking a lot of pride in trying to find those hidden gems in rounds 2 and 3, right? Like, they have 5 draft picks currently in rounds 2 and 3. And we're seeing some NHL superstars, Braden Point, Adam Fox. Those are the guys. And there's so many guys from like the Stanley Cup winning Blackhawks teams, like Nicholas Jalmerson and Dustin Byfuglien and Dave Bolin and Duncan Keith. Like, all those guys were later round draft picks.
Brandon Saad and Andrew Shaw too.
Yeah. And Alex DeBrincat too. Second round pick, you know, so there's so many of those players available, like Mike said, and it's just really trying to find them. And it's taking a lot of pride in finding those types of players. Let's you have one more thing?
No, that's it, man. I want to transition to other front office stuff. I'm just so amped up about this. You see, I've got a giant coffee with me today. Let's go.
I love it. Yeah, the Kyle Davidson did round out. Man, he's been busy, man. Like, he gets the, like, he goes from interim general manager to like interviewing for the permanent general manager gig. And like, as soon as he gets the permanent general manager gig, like, days later, he's making these changes where it's like Mark Kelly is out and like, there's just so many different moving parts. So he adds to his team, he brings back Norm MacIver, and then a few weeks later or a month later, he brings Jeff Greenberg into the mix. And now he's kind of rounding out, he finally rounded out his hockey operations leadership group by with Mark Eaton, who will remain as the assistant general manager of player development. Megan Hunter has been promoted to assistant general manager of hockey operations. So now the Blackhawks are going to have 2 assistant general managers, and then Brian Campbell will remain in the hockey operations as an advisor, who is basically Kyle Davidson's right hand man when he had the interim tag. And then Carolyn Pilch has been promoted to director of player personnel. So it's a unique structure, right, James? You got the general manager who's 34 years old, and then he's got 2 associate general managers. Yep. One a veteran in Norm MacIver, one has a baseball background in Jeff Greenberg. And then now he's got 2 assistant general managers, Mark Eaton, who's focusing on player development and things of that nature. And then Megan Hunter, who's overseeing, let's see, I'm having a brain fart here as I try to find overseeing budgeting, team services, contract execution, team security, and player services. So it's like, it's a unique structure where there are multiple different layers to this front office. What are your thoughts just on the promotions and Kyle Davidson just rounding out his leadership staff?
He's certainly trying to come up with a lot of different ways to include a lot of different voices in the room, right? I think that we kind of looked at him being, you know, 34 years old and kind of evaluating whether or not he was going to need like a really good veteran associate GM. He obviously has that in the form of Norm MacIver. He got, you know, way outside the box when he hired Greenberg to also be an associate. So we kind of already knew that he was willing to have a lot of different voices in the room. And I think that some of these hires really indicate that he's taking that perhaps to a greater level than we even anticipated. I feel like having Megan Hunter in the front office working in hockey ops is going to be really interesting. She's worked in as an amateur scout. She's worked in hockey administration and seen a lot of different, you know, points of view in the organization. And I think it's going to be really interesting to have her, you know, kind of be in charge of, you know, budgeting and all of those different things. It's going to be really critical for, you know, influencing free agents to come here to have a really good lid on all of those things. And so I think that it's going to be fascinating to have her with all of those different viewpoints. I think having Mark Eaton still oversee the Rockford IceHogs and the amateur and pro player development is a really smart move by the Blackhawks. I think that he has been in the organization long enough and has done enough different things that I can really see him thriving in that role. Those obviously were the two kind of main takeaways that I had from the list of hires. I'm also really intrigued to see how much of a role Brian Campbell is going to have in the front office. I mean, they were leaning on him when they were hiring the GM in the first place. So it's fascinating to see that he's still going to be part of the leadership team and part of the mix moving forward. And, you know, we're going to get a really quick look at how this front office structure is going to work when we move through finally hiring a head coach, going into the NHL draft in a couple of weeks, and then into free agency. I just think that some of those names are really kind of jumping off the page at me. And yeah, just the size of the brain trust that Kyle Davidson has assembled is really, really interesting to me. I know that it'd be really easy to try to kind of boil it down to these few people have say, and then we're going to go. But having that many different voices on a project that's going to be as big as this rebuild potentially is going to be is definitely an intriguing strategy, and one that I think could really work out well for them.
Yeah, and it's a lot of people internally that are getting promotions, right? So it's got to be encouraging within the organization, where, you know, if you get a job with the Blackhawks, maybe at a lower level, like, you can quickly work your way up. We saw Kyle Davidson do it as an intern to now the general manager. Megan Hunter, I don't even know if she started in the hockey operations. Like, I think she might have even been in some of the business aspects, right? And then ended up moving over to become a scout and was the director of administration. And now she's assistant general manager. And she has such a decorated background too. Collegiate career, being one of the top female hockey players when she was in college. So it's a very well diverse group that Chicago has put together. And, you know, like you mentioned too, like Brian Campbell, I think him being in an advisory role, like that's a perfect fit for him. Like, I remember when Kyle Davidson got named the permanent general manager on March 1st, and there was like discussion, or there were like early reports that was like Brian Campbell could be you know, a potential assistant general manager, Kyle Davidson's right hand man. And I thought, I'm like, man, that was really risky, because like Brian Campbell doesn't really have that kind of background to, like, typically assistant general managers, they're working on contract negotiations and they're that's nuts and bolts kind of stuff. Like, Brian Campbell, I feel like this is a perfect role for him, kind of be the advisor to Kyle Davidson, be, you know, be in his ear about maybe stylistically ways they want to play, potential players, like stuff like that.
Well, so yeah, just look at the way he played. Like, that's exactly what the Blackhawks are going for, is that kind of offensive, speedy kind of blue line. I think that he fits that, you know, paradigm kind of perfectly, doesn't he?
Yeah, no question. And so I really feel like this is the perfect kind of fit for him. So you have all these, you know, different components to the leadership structure. And I feel like, you know, it could benefit the Blackhawks having a lot of these different, you know, diverse backgrounds, Jeff Greenberg and Megan Hunter and all these different perspectives. It's going to be interesting to see how it all comes together, but it's nice. I'm sure Kyle Davidson feels a little bit of a sense of relief that he finally has his staff together. Right. And yep. He's doing it a few weeks before the NHL draft and free agency when things are really going to pick up. So I'm sure it's one major thing he doesn't have to worry about anymore. All right, James, let's get on. We got to talk about game four last night. We're recording this on Thursday. Obviously, Tampa, Colorado. This felt like winner of that game wins the series, right? Like, if Colorado wins, they go up 3-1, and it's like, I don't know if Tampa can beat Colorado three in a row, especially two in Colorado. And then you felt like if Tampa would have evened it up at 2-2, you know, then the momentum is going the other way, and maybe there's a goalie controversy in Colorado and Vasilevsky's heating up, and it feels like Tampa gets better as the series goes on. But that didn't happen, and it was a very controversial game-winning goal in overtime by Nazem Kadri, and we have to kind of break it down in real time. There were so many different layers that it was like, first of all, no one knew that the puck went in the net, not even Nazem Kadri, right? Yeah. Like, it was, I see like a lot of comparisons to the Patrick Kane goal in 2010, and it, no question, it fell right in there because no one knew it went in. But like, Patrick Kane knew that it went in Philly. Like, Nazem Kadri didn't even know that it went in. I think it was Bowen Byram that was the only guy that really saw the puck go in the net, and he like skated from the neutral zone to below the goal line and like was pointing at the puck, like right in front of the referee, pointing at it that it got stuck in the upper part of the net.
Yeah, Wes McCauley was just kind of staring in the general direction and didn't seem to see the puck.
Yeah, so that was bizarre in and of itself. But then John Cooper steps up to the podium and he takes one question and he says, I'll be available tomorrow. And something along the lines of, you guys will see it, but we should still be playing right now. And everyone's like, wait, what? So now we're all replaying. Like, I went back and I looked. I was like, what could he be talking about? Like a potential offside? Like, was one of the guys late? Was it a delayed offside and Kadri entered the zone prematurely? Or, you know, was it too many men? And so then you look and it's like, oh, wow. Like, this is very clearly too many men on the ice penalty that went miscalled. James, I want to throw it over to you. What were your thoughts on it? Because I have a couple thoughts, but I want to hear your take on it first. Like, what did you see? Like, should it have been called? And like, this stuff happens all the time.
Sure.
But I will clarify why I don't think this specific situation is not a, it might be a common occurrence, but it should have been called, and I'll explain why, but I want to throw it over to you first.
I think my biggest takeaway is that I would really like to know why it's not specifically reviewable, because it's not, too many men is not a reviewable play, is it?
No. I believe in overtime, I don't think there are challenges, right? I think it's every review is initiated by the NHL, right? Like, yeah. Anytime there's a goalie or anytime there's something close, they review it. I believe that's the case. So
it seems odd to me that if you can challenge an offside or really encourage the officials to look at an offside, I really want to know why you can't look at a too many men penalty and do the same thing. I think that obviously can impact the outcome of games, as we saw last night. I get the sense that that's something that the league should be able to review. I feel like them, whether or not they called it, is, you know, going to be up for endless debates here. And I think that you can make an argument either way that, you know, oh, how much of an impact did it have directly on the play? You know, should they have called it? Yada. I just think that it should be reviewable. And I think that if John Cooper sees that on the monitor, that he should be able to call the official over and go, hey, you need to look at that on video and you need to rule that there were six skaters on the ice for Colorado. I think that that's something that the league needs to address. And it seems kind of odd to me that if you can have all of these like weird iterations of rules around whether or not a play is onside and you can review those, you need to be able to review whether or not a play had too many men on the ice.
Yeah, I think it's probably not reviewable because it's subjective, right? Like, there's nothing in the rule book that says, you know,
the 5-foot rule is like the only real, you know, thing that's in the rule book about too many men is if a guy is within 5 feet of the bench, they generally will give them a little bit of leeway unless they're playing the puck. But I think that,
right.
I would think that if that's going to be the case and you're going to have that rule, that seems to me something you can pretty easily see on video. Then if he's more than 5 feet from the bench, then bam, it should be a penalty upon review.
Right. Here's my biggest issue with it and why it was a blatantly miscall. When we see this in games in the past, like guys, let's say Patrick Kane is leaving the ice and Alex DeBrincat is hopping on for Kane. Like, Alex DeBrincat, sometimes he, like, if you're Alex DeBrincat, you can hop over the boards and you can notice if the play is coming towards you, you intentionally do not play the puck until Patrick Kane is on the ice, right?
Right.
So we've seen situations like that. Or if a guy jumps onto the ice and it's total, like the play, let's just say the play's in the offensive zone or the defensive zone where it's totally away from the bench. We've seen guys jump on early, right, and try to enter the zone. That feels like fine. They're going to let it slide. This goal specifically, though, Nazem Kadri came on for Nathan MacKinnon. Like, yeah. That's a center for center exchange. And MacKinnon is the last one off the ice, and Nazem Kadri is the last one off the bench. So, like, when Kadri comes off the bench, by the time the camera is panning on him, like, Kadri, like, has the puck, and MacKinnon is still not on the bench yet. So, like, Kadri would have jumped on the ice when Nathan MacKinnon was probably still closer to the goal than the bench, right? So that's a blatant offside, or that's a blatant too many men on the ice penalty.
Yeah.
So that's where it's so different, where like it's not like the play was like away from it. And Nazem Kadri jumped early. Like that is a Nazem Kadri jumping on from Nathan MacKinnon. And that is his guy. That is a too many men on the ice penalty. Yeah. And James, we also need to dispel this. Like I saw out there that Tampa, they're like Tampa had seven guys on the ice. That is happening so far away from the play. And it's not an offside it's not a too many men on the ice penalty for those Tampa Bay players, because it's happening away from the play. And they're like, that exchange is happening. It's like on the, like the 5 foot rule, like you said, it would have been too many money on the ice for Tampa Bay if those guys were playing the puck. Right. But the fact that Kadri played the puck, like, and Nathan MacKinnon was coming off the ice, like that was his guy, man, that's a tough missed call. But then on the flip side, James, I saw that last Eastern Conference final, Tampa Bay, this went their way, where the New York Islanders had seven guys on the ice. And I believe it was game seven in an Yanni Gourde, and they won 1-0 in game seven. And like, that was the game winning goal, right? So, hey, sometimes you get the break, sometimes you don't, but it was just unfortunate that it happened in overtime.
I think what I don't understand is also the people who are saying that, you know, oh, well, you know, if you're going to bring up stuff from like, you know, 2019 or whatever to like justify what potential too many men penalty here, like just you can miss me with all of that, man. Like, let's just focus on the issue at hand. I feel like the fact that it's not subject to video review, I do feel is strange. Like, if you can review all these other things, why you can't review that is kind of beyond me. And I know that they're, you know, there's elements of judgment call to it as well. And that's what the NHL said in their kind of defense of the way that the officials kind of handled it last night. But there's also some kind of black and white elements to that rule too. And I think that, as you pointed out correctly, with Nathan MacKinnon being so far from the bench when Nazem Kadri jumped on the ice, I feel like if that had been reviewable, they would have ended up assessing the penalty and the game would have gone on. We also need to, of course, bring up the elephant in the room, which is that Colorado was bludgeoning Tampa to death in that entire overtime period. Like, it was only a matter of time until they scored. They clearly had the legs and Tampa did not. So, I mean, John Cooper can say all he wants, oh, we'd still be playing. Nah, he probably wouldn't be. But, you know, it's fine. Like, I have to give Tampa credit. They very clearly throughout the series have been the team that's had more miles on their legs, and they've been a step slower than Colorado has been, but they've really held it together really well. Winning game three the way they did was really impressive. They could have won last night if a few bounces had potentially gone their way, and we could be looking at a completely different series right now. So while I do have to say to John Cooper, you would have ended sooner rather than later, and most likely in Colorado's favor, regardless of the outcome of that play, I do think that, you know, you do have to give Tampa credit for the way they've continued to fight in this series.
Yeah, for sure. I do think Colorado has been the better team for four games. So like them going back home up 3-1, it doesn't feel like, it feels like that's probably how it should be, right? Like Colorado has been the better team. Although you can argue, I mean, Tampa Bay, they were really good in the first period of game four. I think they were out shooting them like 17-4 at one point. Yeah. So like Tampa Bay definitely had their, chances to really make this a series. I'm gonna throw it to you. Does this get done on Friday? Do you think Colorado closes it out? I think so, right?
I think so, and that's not a knock on Tampa Bay. I think that they have shown once again that their adjustments are just incredible. The way that they're able to roll with the punches in a series, and no matter how bad things look, I mean, they looked completely decimated after game two, and Steven Stamkos was, you know, furious about the way they had played. John Cooper wasn't thrilled about it. Then they turned around in game three and they came out and they won on home ice. I mean, that's just the kind of team that they are. It would not shock me at all if they won game five and forced this to go back to Tampa, but I'm still going to say that Colorado's finishing it off in game five. I just think that they're the more well-rested team. Their speed is really giving Tampa a lot of issues because of kind of the exhaustion we're seeing on behalf of the champs there. And it just looks like a matter of time before we're going to see a champ coronated, because the Avs just look like such an incredible team.
Yeah. And Tampa, the reason why I feel like Colorado is going to get it done on Friday is because Tampa is so decimated right now. Like, not having, like, Braden Point gave it a go in the first two games, and he's just very clearly not healthy, right? And then Eric Chernak gets hurt last game. Nicholas Paul got hurt in the early part of the series, and then I think Brandon Hagel might have gotten hurt in overtime. So it's like Tampa is just, they're dropping like flies quickly, and Colorado is seemingly, I know they lost Andre Burakovsky, but then you get Nazem Kadri back, and it's like, that's so lethal for them down the middle. And Nathan MacKinnon hasn't even been playing to like the standard that we're known from him, right? So it's not like Colorado is winning based on their superstar power. They're just, you know, they're just winning based on their depth and their speed. All right, last one, James, last topic. I wanted to get to the NHL awards, because I can officially, we can officially talk about it without me being secretive of who I might have picked for my ballot. So I think the two trophies or the awards that we are really kind of focused on was who's going to win the Norris. Was it going to be Roman Josi or Cale Makar? And then I don't know. I don't necessarily know if it was going to be who's going to win the Hart, because I think we had a pretty good idea of Austin Matthews. But I feel like seeing the actual voting, the results of like 1 to 12, like how did that shape out? So let's start with the Norris Trophy really quick. Are you surprised Cale Makar won over Roman Josi? Now I will say, so I had Cale Makar 1, I had Roman Josi 2 on my ballot. Cale Makar won the actual Norris Trophy, but Roman Josi had more first place votes. It was 98 to 92. So that was interesting. The fact that Roman Josi garnered more first place votes than Cale Makar, but Makar still won by like the slimmest of margins. Any surprise in that?
I'm not surprised that it was as close as it was. I'm not surprised that Cale Makar ended up narrowly edging Josi out. What I am surprised about, I'm not the world's greatest mathematician, but I take great umbrage with the fact that a voter did not have Roman Josi on their ballot at all.
Okay, wait.
What sport are you watching that is not in your top five?
Time out, James. Do you know who it was?
Who was it?
It was a Chicago writer.
Who was it?
It was Scotty Powers.
Why?
Yes.
Scotty Powers, why have you let me down? Man.
I love Scotty. I'm not going to say anything bad about him, because I
adore Scott Powers, for the record. Yeah. I've said that, I've podcasted about hockey and written about hockey for quite a while, and Scott Powers is quite possibly not only the best dude I know that does the hockey beat writer thing, but he's also brilliant. I still take great umbrage with the fact Roman Josi wasn't on his ballot. What's going on here?
Okay, wait, time out. I don't even have a, that is a separate issue. But let's move on to the Hart Trophy, because there was a writer that left both Austin Matthews and Connor McDavid off the ballot, off the Hart Trophy ballot. I don't know how that's possible. I think JT Miller was on the ballot, but not.
I'm gonna go ahead and say, like, you defended in the public sphere. Why? How are they not in the top five players in the league this year? Seriously, I want to hear a defense that Austin Matthews was not one of the top five players in the league this year.
Yeah, and you know what? I feel like I've said this on the podcast, and I was able to say this without giving away who I picked, but like, one of my biggest pet peeves about the NHL awards is that sometimes we can overthink like most valuable player versus like who the best players in the league were, right? Like the fact that Sidney Crosby only has 2 Hart trophies and he's a top 5 player of all time. Like, how much of that was he got docked because of, oh, he played with Malkin, like his career. So like Malkin, obviously Crosby can't win MVP, because if you got Malkin on there, who's also like a top 10 player at the time, how could you give Crosby the MVP? Right. So like,
yeah. And we kind of got into that a little bit when we were discussing handicapping it, for sure. I can see that.
Yeah. And it's like, again, like, I think that the example I used in the past was like, Taylor Hall has a Hart Trophy. It's like, which is fine. Like, you deserve the MVP that season. But like, when guys are getting inducted into the Hall of Fame and Connor McDavid is not a 6-time Hart Trophy winner, or Crosby is a 2-time Hart Trophy winner, it feels a little weird that he doesn't have more, right? And it feels a little weird that like the best player of our generation, Sidney Crosby, like only has, you know, 2 Hart trophies. So anyway, I digress. The one thing I did want to get into that was interesting is like Igor Shesterkin. So full disclosure, like, I left him off my ballot entirely. One to five with us voters, we got to rank them 1 to 5. And I left him off my ballot completely. And it wasn't necessarily a knock on Igor Shesterkin, as opposed to there were so many qualified candidates: Leon Draisaitl, Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, Johnny Gaudreau, Kirill Kaprizov, like Kale McCarr, Roman Yost. There were so many candidates that like I had such a high standard for a goaltender getting on my ballot that it was like, you had to have a historically good season to make my ballot. If you're a goaltender, right? And I had two things that really knocked out Shesterkin to below my five. And it was the fact that he only started 52 games. Like you look at previous goalies. So I was doing some research, like the last 50 years, there have been three goalies to win the Hart. It's Carey Price, Dominic Hasek twice, and Jose Theodore. Carey Price in 2015, he started 66 games. He was 44-16-6 with a 1.9 goals against average, .933 save percentage, and 9 shutouts. Like, that's ridiculously good. Like, they were leaning on him so heavily. And then Dominic Hasek, 1998. Get a load of this. He started 72 games and he had 13 shutouts, right? And then the year prior, he started 66 games, .930 save percentage, 5 shutouts. And then Jose Theodore won it in 2012. He started 67 games. So like all of those goaltenders were like critical parts of the team. And when I look at Igor Shesterkin, 52 starts, which is totally fine. He had a historically good season. It was like a 34 goal saved above expected, which was like historically good. But like Alexander Georgiev, when he was in that, the Rangers were 15-10-2. So like there wasn't a significant drop off like in their record. So like, I don't know, poke holes in my argument, James. Like, am I being too harsh on Shesterkin that I left him off the ballot? Because I saw some people had him one, and it's totally good. But like, if he started 66 games like Carey Price did in 2015, and he put up the same numbers, like that would have been way more impressive because they were really riding and dying with him. And you know, it's like workload too. Like Shesterkin was like fresh, you know. So like, I don't know. Like, what do you think?
I think we've discussed the idea of a goaltender winning the Hart, and I think that your argument that it has to be like a historically good season is very well taken. It's very similar to a pitcher winning the most valuable player award in baseball, aside from Shohei Ohtani, of course. Like he's on a completely different plane of existence, basically. So we're not going to, for the sake of this conversation, we'll leave him out. But I agree with you that a guy who barely played over 50 games should not be considered the league's best player. I think that he deserved to be in the conversation at least. I mean, there were a lot of guys who had incredible seasons. Jonathan Huberdeau, Johnny Gaudreau both had really good seasons. I think that Shesterkin finishing third was kind of surprising to me, that he finished that far ahead and got 24 first place votes and Johnny Gaudreau only got 3. That really surprised me. The fact Roman Yossi got more votes than Johnny Gaudreau did was also very surprising. I still, to me, when I look down the voting list, like I am astonished the only player on the Colorado Avalanche who got any Hart Trophy votes at all was Cale Makar, and he only got 1 second place vote. He didn't get any first place votes at all. Kirill Kaprizov from Minnesota got 2 first place votes. Johnny Gaudreau got 3. Roman Yossi got 5. You're telling me those guys were more valuable and had more outstanding seasons this year than Cale Makar did? That's hard for me to, you know, understand. But
I'm really glad that you mentioned that too, because that's also part of the reason why I left Shesterkin off, because of that logic. Like Nathan MacKinnon is very clearly like one of the best players in the world, right? And he like
did not get a single top 5 vote for MVP.
But do you know why? Because listen, 88 points in 65 games. So his points per game average was 1.35. That was basically top 6 players in the league, but he only played 65 games. So like Igor Shesterkin, he started 52 games, and I think he missed multiple weeks with an injury. So like if we're going to dock Nathan MacKinnon that he didn't play full 82, like
Well, how are we going to also being docked that he plays for the Colorado Avalanche and they're stocked but really good players.
But I think I'm going to do this math on the fly right now. So, like, I think if Nathan MacKinnon, let's just say he played a full 82-game season, I'm doing this, 88 points divided by 65 multiplied 17.
Math is always really entertaining.
He would have finished with 111 points, and it would have been fourth, right above Leon Draisaitl and right behind McDavid, Goudreau, and Huberdeau. And I bet you Nathan MacKinnon is on heart ballots, like, is on basically everyone's heart ballot if he played a full 82-game season. So, like, that's another reason why I left off Shesterkin, because, like, if we're going to dock goalies for – or if we're going to dock skaters for that they didn't play a full season, or they only played 70 games or so, like, 52 starts is, like – and also, too, James, so I was looking at the 2015 Carey Price stats. So he had a – this is according to Evolving Hockey – he had a 38.8 goal saved above expected. The next goalie was Andrei Pavlik, 20. So, like, it was like a ridiculous drop off with Shesterkin. He had a 37.2. So, like, right there, right in the Carey Price range, yep. 14 fewer starts though. And the next best goalie was Freddie Anderson at 28. So it was like a difference of 9. So, like, then if Shesterkin's in the heart conversation, if he should be number one on ballots, why isn't Freddie Anderson closer to the heart, right? Like, I don't know.
Freddie Anderson finished fourth in Vezina voting, by the way. Did you have any issues with the way the Vezina shook out?
Well, I feel like Saros and Vasilevsky, they were finalists because they played more games. Like, Saros started like 60 plus games, and yeah. You know, and Freddie Anderson only started what, 52 games played. So yeah. Like, right there with Shesterkin, 52.
And also Anderson did get a first place vote in the Vezina, as did Vasilevsky, as did Sorokin. You know who didn't? Yeah, Jacob Markstrom didn't get a single first place vote.
Yeah, that was interesting. He led the league in shutouts. So I will say, full disclosure, this was my heart bout, James. Austin Matthews 1, Connor McDavid 2, Johnny Gaudreau 3, Leon Draisaitl 4. And I had Jonathan Huberdeau 5. And I actually think
how am I supposed to, like, be mad at that ballot? I think that's a really good ballot.
I think the one where you can kind of poke a hole through it is Leon Draisaitl at number 4. But, like, I'm sorry, this guy is a top 4 player in the world, top 3 probably. Yep. And I'm not leaving him off my ballot. You take away McDavid from Edmonton, they're a borderline playoff team. You take away Draisaitl from Edmonton and McDavid stays, they're still a borderline playoff team. Like, they, Leon Draisaitl. It goes back to my, like, original argument. Like, if this guy is going to be, when it's all said and done, he might be like a top 5 player of, like, our generation, Crosby, McDavid, Matthews, MacKinnon, Draisaitl, like, those 5 players.
Slander will not stand.
Yeah. I mean, Ovechkin. Yeah. This Kucherov. Maybe I'm being, but look at the postseason Leon Draisaitl had too. And I know this award is regular season only.
Well, like, yeah. Leon Draisaitl, that would probably explain why Shesterkin finished third if it was postseason included too.
Right. Yeah. No, we submit this. The deadline is the day before, or the day of playoffs. So the day the playoffs start. Yeah. So this is, anyway, I'm going to get off my soapbox now, but I feel really good about that ballot. And I know Shesterkin's not on there, but, like, I feel like my reasons are not far-fetched. Uh-huh. Like, you have to have a historically good season and play a ton of hockey for you to really get on that as a goalie. And he was he won the Vezina, and he was, like, far and away the runaway winner. And he very clearly should have been. So, like, you know, he went home with a trophy. 50
some odd games.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, I can't let the podcast end without saying why Scott Powers left Roman Josi off of his Norris ballot, because I said that I took great umbrage with the decision, and I'm still going to say that I think Scott should have had him in his top 5, and leaving him off the ballot was just not correct. But here's what he said. He replied to Mitt Romney, it looks like, which is very odd. I honestly,
the real Mitt Romney?
No. The guy's name is Mitts Romney. I'm assuming that's like a hockey thing. But anyway, I honestly didn't think he was enough of a two-way defenseman to be considered for the award this season. His offense was special, but his defensive metrics were below average. The award shouldn't just be for the top offensive defenseman. I could see where I maybe should have put him 4th or 5th. So there you go. That is Scott Powers' defense of why he wrongly did not include Roman Josi on his ballot for the Norris at all.
Well, here, I will say, I don't mind that reasoning, right? The problem is that there's no award for defensive defenseman.
Thank you.
Right. So like if there was an award, if there was the Nicholas Jalmerson award, who would have been a 10 time winner for the defensive defenseman award. If there was such thing, then there's a separation between like, all right, who's just the best defenseman? Like who is the best defenseman in the league? Like Cale Makar is like not the, I mean, he's a really underrated like defensive defenseman, but like he's not like the best shutdown defenseman in the National Hockey League. He's just a really good defenseman.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the discrepancy is. Like maybe there are just some voters, some writers that have different interpretations of the award, which is totally fair.
And you also can't understate the impact that Devon Taves has on Cale Makar's defense either. Like who's right. Roman Josi skating with in Nashville nowadays? Like,
Right.
I'm not going to hold like him being below average. It's like, yeah, he plays for the friggin' Nashville Predators, bro. Like, come on. Yeah. And I know there are metrics for that. And I'm sure Scott would hit me over the head with the math and make me look like a giant idiot. But just
Scott, I feel like we're dragging Scott in the mud here. And I'm not trying to.
No,
well, it's interesting. Interestingly, though, he left Trevor Zegras off his Calder ballot as well. So that was also like. An interesting decision by Scott.
Trying to argue that Zegras should have won the Calder because of the highlight reel goals he put up or something like that, like the impact that he had, like from a like the way the team looked perspective. It's like no. Let's not start doing that, please. Yeah. Let's not turn the Calder into an ESPY or something, man. Come on.
Yeah. More. Listen, Trevor Zegras is gonna probably win. He'll win some awards throughout his career. Moritz Seider was definitely the Calder.
1,000% agree.
Yeah,
with that.
For sure. Scotty, I love you. He's not listening to this podcast, but
no, he isn't. But I must again say that I love Scott Powers, and you can love somebody and still disagree with their logic and their voting. So
yeah, we have a good relationship. It's more of like a brotherly kind of like disagreement, right? You know, you have some disagreements, but then in the end, you guys still love each other. So
absolutely,
Scotty, much
man.
Love. All right, James, that's going to do it for this edition of the Blackhawks Talk podcast. Thanks for listening to my rants on the NHL awards.
This doofus not including Shesterkin on his Hart Trophy ballot. What a guy.
I will go to my grave with that. The problem is I don't get into Twitter arguments, right? Like it's not worth it. So like if you disagree, totally fine, but I'm not going to get into like a Twitter spat. Like I'd love to have a conversation with you, James, on the podcast about it.
Should I start one with you? Should I start a Twitter feud with you over this?
I won't reply.
Fine. I'll just bludgeon you then. It'll be fun.
All right, James. Good stuff. We'll see you next week.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.